From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. This week, we're listening back to some of our favorite Casey Currents stories of the year. Hear how area law enforcement seeks justice for petty crimes.
The minute you call the police, it will come. It will help. But the sad part is, like, you will see those people in the street again.
Plus, how the business of bucking bulls is gaining popularity and prestige.
You know, we're trying to, you know, get animals that have lots of kick, speed, intensity, you know, where they're really whipping.
And how one area horn maker helps create the signature brass sound of New Orleans.
My teacher came up to me and said, "Mike, I think you would really enjoy making horns." And I said to him, "I didn't even think of that. You know, I guess somebody's got to make them."
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. This is Casey Currents. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We take you to neighborhoods around the region using voices, stories, and sound.
This hour, we're listening to some of our best and favorite stories from the year. We'll start the hour with a piece by our intern, Zach Lewandowski. He's been doing great work with us since late spring.
The holiday season is a time which brings joy to many. For business owners, that joy comes from peaks in profits. People are buying things, but they are also taking them. Theft crimes significantly increase around the holidays, and as Zach found out, business owners have been bracing for a time when profits could walk right out the door.
Have you ever been a victim of theft? Maybe you had your cell phone or wallet stolen. It wasn't the end of the world, but it certainly made your life harder. Theft crimes like these are often referred to as petty crimes. We may only have to deal with it a few times in our lives, but for business owners, the situation is much more common. Muhammad Hakim owns Broadway Cellular, a cell phone store in Westport. For Muhammad, the sound of jingle bells and Santa's reindeer usually mean another sound. But it can also mean this.
In 5 years, a lot of break-in happened, especially in this area at night. Always after 6 o'clock, it get really kind of scary.
Muhammad's store is relatively small in space, but packed with electronics from wall to wall. These high-dollar items combined with the location of his store put Muhammad's business at risk for theft. Muhammad says that in his 5 years of business, he's pretty much seen it all when it comes to what thieves will try.
Yeah, the worst one when somebody back up with his, he cannot break the window, so he back up with his fan inside the window just to get a place to get in. The damage was costing more than whatever he steal.
That theft caused $3,500 worth of damage alone and forced him to close his shop for 2 weeks. After these thefts occur, Muhammad says he usually calls police, but according to him, that doesn't always solve the problem.
The minute you call the police, it will come. It will help. But the sad part is, like, you will see those people in the street again.
I spoke with Sergeant Mike Foster, who heads the Central Property Crimes Unit of the Kansas City Police Department. When a victim reports a theft to police, a detective then investigates the incident to try and build a case for prosecution. Foster says that often what slows a case down is a lack of follow-through by the victim.
You know, people move on, and by the time 6 months later comes around, we'll call them up and say, "Hey, listen, we've solved your case. I know it's been a while, but we need you to come down and give a statement. Well, you know, I don't really want to be involved anymore."
Foster says it can be frustrating to close a case without charging someone. But he also points out that just because someone is charged doesn't mean they'll be spending a lot of time behind bars.
The court system tries to rehabilitate these people, especially property crimes individuals. You know, they send them to drug rehab. They send them to, and that's what we try to explain to them, is it's not like he's going to prison for a year. He's going to get help. They'll offer him help. If he doesn't follow through with the help, he violates his probation, and then he can go to jail.
The holiday season is a time when police see an increase in crimes across the board, and thieves can get pretty inventive when it comes to stealing.
You know, typically on Christmas time, you have a lot of boosters that might run into a store and grab a handful and bolt out. Or you have the professional boosters where they'll come in with sacks and they'll put the items in the sack and they'll be lined with special outfitting things like aluminum foil or something like that that will not detect as they leave.
These clever methods of thievery make it all the more important for business owners to stay vigilant. At Broadway Cellular, Muhammad has taken it upon himself to beef up security. He installed magnetic locks on the front door. And a button behind the register gives Muhammad the opportunity to lock someone out or even keep someone in.
Sometimes, like, people, I know he's going to steal something or he stole something before and he ran away. He come back to try to do it again, so the minute he get in, I lock the door inside and just call the police.
Muhammad has seemingly gone above and beyond the call of duty. He's got several security cameras around the store. His dog, Gooch, who lurks behind the counter during store hours, was even sent to special training classes to protect him from intruders. He even made the choice to live in the same building as his business, just to better protect it. He says he spent around $5,000 of his own cash for security, but the money spent has been well worth it.
It cost me a lot, but at least it will let me know what happened. Because before that, I just come in the morning and I see the door open and the whole store is just a mess. So at least the camera helped me to know which customer is bad, who stole.
Muhammad's security upgrades allow him to gather more information about potential thieves. You've probably seen signs in stores that say, owners will prosecute for theft. But city prosecutor Lowell Gard says that what makes theft crimes hard to pursue is a lack of solid witnesses.
Well, I think the biggest challenge is getting the witnesses to show up. We have to prove everything beyond a reasonable doubt. That's a big challenge sometimes when we don't have a witness.
The prosecution office categorizes theft under general ordinance crimes. On average, they see over 30,000 general ordinance cases a year. Last December saw more cases than any month so far this year, meaning that December is a popular month for theft. Gard says items like alcohol and expensive electronics are among those most likely to be stolen around the holidays. But trying to predict what people will steal is pretty much impossible.
People steal chickens. They steal groceries. They steal makeup. They steal contraceptives. Anything that will fit into a pocket or purse. Some things that don't fit.
Gard says that people can get impatient with theft crimes because they think it's as simple as catching the thief with the item. But theft crimes still have a process, and innocent until proven guilty means Gard must build a solid case to convict.
We do a lot better job when we have a persistent complaining witness, a person who is willing to take off work or leave the store or send an employee. We need some commitment from the public to make our jobs work too.
Sometimes suspects who are picked up for theft charges can post bond, making it possible for them to be back on the street the same day that they were picked up. Foster says that can be frustrating for store owners, but adds this bit of advice.
Know the people that come in your store. If they've been in there before and they've committed a crime, you know they've committed a crime, file trespass charges on them. It's still your business. You don't have to have them come back.
Back at Broadway Cellular, Muhammad continues to help customers as they walk in. And while Muhammad agrees shares responsibility in keeping his store safe, he says that his holiday wish list includes more police presence.
If, like, the police walk in here more or drive by here most of the time, it would be really good.
But Muhammad admits that things have gotten better lately, especially with his improved security. And this is probably a good thing, because in 2011, property crimes alone cost the U.S. an estimated $15.6 billion. With the economy what it is, that brings to light that the cost of these petty crimes isn't so petty after all. For KCUR, I'm Zach Lewandowski.
Free health clinics have long been places to turn when you don't have health insurance or any money to pay for care. The federal health law, though, could expand health coverage to up to 30 million people. Through the law, states have the option to expand their Medicaid programs. Individuals and small businesses may also soon qualify for subsidies for purchasing insurance on so-called health exchanges or online marketplaces that are slated to go live in 2014.
And while the health law has faced legal challenges in the past year and some uncertainty around a few of its provisions, health providers have already been gearing up for a potential surge in patients with insurance. As KCUR's Alana Gordon reports, that leaves free clinics in uncharted territory.
Around the country, hundreds of free clinics have been established over the last 50 years to treat patients like Patsy Duarte.
That's no good. 172 over 85.
Duarte's getting her blood pressure checked at Duchesne Clinic in Kansas City, Kansas. The Sisters of Charity of Leavenworth helped form the clinic in this old parish school about 20 years ago. There's an affiliate in Leavenworth. Duarte's been coming here for years for her hypertension, diabetes, and other health issues.
I have no insurance. I have no other means of going to a doctor. The last time that my husband went to a doctor, it was like $85 just for the visit.
Duarte says medical conditions limit her ability to work, and the couple's combined income is about $15,000 a year. The bad economy, the loss of jobs and health insurance, has also meant more people are turning to the clinic, according to director Amy Folk.
We've been kind of caught in the perfect storm of you have so many people needing care that can't get care, but at the same time, funding, you know, has been held level or in some cases decreased. So while you'd like to ramp up, this is not the economic time to do that.
And with big changes coming in the health system, folks says the clinic faces a lot of uncertainty right now. While uninsured people can and do go to community health centers and hospitals, free clinics are the only place where there's no fear of a bill. An optional expansion of Medicaid to millions of people means many of those who go to free clinics may soon get coverage. Nicole Lamoureux-Busby, head of the National Association of Free and Charitable Clinics, says free clinics expect to still be an important part of the healthcare safety net. Millions of people still won't have coverage.
The Congressional Budget Office itself says that there are going to be anywhere from 23 to 29 million uninsured people left in this country. So first and foremost, we will continue to service as the gap fillers in this country. We've always been the net under the safety net, and now we recognize that there still are going to be those people that don't have access to health care.
In the Kansas City area, that could translate to an estimated 85,000 uninsured people. Lamoureux-Busby says many clinics will also have a role in helping people figure out the new system.
It sounds great to have everyone be eligible between 2014 and 2019, but there's not this magic potion or a magic wand that's going to get people signed up. Somebody's going to have to help them. We're going to have to explain now a very complicated system that quite frankly ignored many of our patients in the past.
Duchesne Free Clinic Director Amy Falk says the clinic's already been responding to a changing health system by trying to be more of a primary care center for patients. The clinic's thought a lot about the situation and the access challenges patients already face.
I don't think we can stay as we are. I think we have to grow within our environment.
Folk says the harsh reality is the region's safety net system is already stretched thin and wrestling with how to respond to current needs. If anything, Folk predicts more people will be turning to Duchesne Clinic for care in the future. So she says the clinic has decided to take Medicaid and private insurance if health coverage expands.
It will totally change the culture and structure of this clinic. Having never had to do these things and building the infrastructure, one, to put in place, but just how we do our daily workflow, it will change.
For those who decide to go in this direction, taking Medicaid and private insurance could alter the nature of free clinics who rely on volunteers like Dr. Glenn Hodges of the Health Partnership Clinic in Overland Park.
I'm a medical missionary 3 miles from where I live, taking care of people in my neighborhood.
Dr. Hodges has been a happy volunteer at the Health Partnership Clinic since he retired from the VA more than 10 years ago. This clinic is making some sweeping changes, regardless of what happens with the federal health law, that will include taking Medicaid and private coverage and qualifying for more federal funds. The white-bearded Hodges, who's also a master rose gardener, says he plans to stay with the clinic. He and most other volunteers will focus on patients who don't have coverage. Staff will focus on those with coverage.
Patients who are receiving free care are going to continue to be there. It's two separate patient populations, will require two separate administrative organizational structures. There's a need for both.
That attitude is great news for new Health Partnership Clinic Director Jason Wesco, who used to run a community health center in Kansas that took insurance.
We're in the midst of rethinking what insured means. and uninsured. Because historically, the uninsured have been the people without the plastic card, right? It has had nothing to do with their health needs or their health status or anything else. It's had to do with whether they have a card. So like today, I have a card. If I quit my job and go to work for somebody else tomorrow, I may or may not have a card. It doesn't have anything to do with me. It's completely employer-based or whether you have a public benefit. And so if healthcare reform continues as is currently law, that changes a lot about our patients. Or does it? It might mean they have a piece of plastic in their pocket. They have the same healthcare needs. They're the same people who have not been getting healthcare for all their lives or getting it at the ER at very expensive ways.
Wesco knows the transition to accepting insurance takes planning, like training staff and putting in an electronic medical record system. He knows he'll still need volunteers like Dr. Hodges, though, as well as more paid staff to handle extra patients and manage the changes.
I exist to help my patients get healthier and to take care of as many of as I can in the highest quality manner possible. So how do I create a system where I can bill for services? Well, you know, I do. I just do it. Just like I created a system to manage 100 volunteers. That, to me, is a lot harder than billing Medicaid.
For clinics who go in this direction, there can be bigger changes, too, involving malpractice coverage and, in some states, changing Medicaid laws.
The bottom line is we have growing need, and our job is to worry about all those people we don't take care of, and how do I get the resources to make sure that no one in Johnson County goes without health care. That's a big job, and the only way I can adequately do that is bring more resources to this organization.
Free clinic directors say the next few years will be hard work, but they say with decades of stretching resources, responding to changing community needs, and caring for people with complex health problems, they'll rise to the challenge. Alana Gordon, KCUR News.
This story, which originally aired in the spring, is part of a partnership with KCUR, NPR, and Kaiser Health News. Find the latest updates on how free clinics in Kansas City have since undergone some big changes in light of the federal health law on our website at kcur.org and click on Health.
Coming up, the best of Casey Currents this year continues with some creative ways of dealing with foreclosure and the booming industry of bucking bulls. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.
This is our Casey Currents Year in Review. We're listening back to some of our favorite Casey Currents stories from 2012. Foreclosures were down by about 25% in both Missouri and Kansas during the first quarter of 2012. But it's still common for banks to take more than a year to even begin the foreclosure process. This leaves a lot of owners and tenants in a limbo without legal guidelines. Back in May, Alex told us the story of a school teacher who's using this state of limbo to create a haven for artists.
About 3.5 years ago, school teacher Elizabeth Sherman moved into the carriage house of a mansion in Hyde Park. The mansion is a mostly stone Victorian shingle style built in 1903. She liked the old building, the neighborhood, and the friendly landlord who lived in the mansion itself. Little did she know how precarious her newly found home was. Sitting on the big porch on a warm spring afternoon, Sherman remembers when she found out about her landlord's financial problems.
About a year ago, he called me and let me know he was probably going to lose the property he had in Kansas City and he was going to leave town. I was worried about him when he called, so I said, should I come over? Should I bring a bottle of wine? You know, we're right next door. So I did, and we had a long talk, and he said, you know, I'm going to leave, but I'm going to give you a key to the house in case you want to use it for anything.
Not only did Elizabeth Sherman have full use of a mansion, but with no landlord, she wouldn't have to pay rent. Figuring that anything too good to be true probably is, she went looking for advice.
My dad has some experience as a landlord-tenant attorney, so he was my first phone call when this all happened to figure out, because my landlord said, oh, you can stay, you know, it could be 6 months, it could be a year, it could be 2 years. But I was not sure about doing that until I actually talked to my dad, and he said, no, that sounds right to me. I think you will be all right. And he has a basement, a large basement.
A large finished basement
that wayward children could move into in a pinch also.
That second voice is Elizabeth's co-conspirator and sister, Valerie. The Shermans started small. They threw parties for friends, gave informal tours of the mansion, and set up a miniature golf course in the giant master bedroom. But in December of last year, the fun came to a stop when Elizabeth's gas and water were suddenly turned off. Along with the landlord, the mansion had housed a few tenants, and they'd left behind several months' worth of unpaid utility bills.
People had left huge bills, $700, $800 bills at both places. But I wasn't paying rent anymore, so I just started making payments to them instead. And I think I still owe the water company $200. But other than that, I got everything paid up so that they would come out and turn all the utilities on. The problem when they tried to turn the water on was that we realized that somebody had broken in and stolen all the copper. Pipes, the air conditioner, coil that was copper, all the water heaters they had stolen.
Part of Elizabeth's tour now includes a stop in the basement where the copper thieves broke in. From the bottom of a dark, musty stone stairwell, you can see where they came in through a basement door window. She reported the break-in and robbery to the police, who came to investigate. When the police asked Elizabeth what she was doing on the property, she showed them her old lease and explained the situation. And that was good enough for the police to let her stay.
Apparently, in this brave new world of foreclosures, this is not as odd as it might have been years back. I mean, it was clear I didn't have a real motive for, you know, I showed them where I live, and I'm here, I've been here. It was not as odd as I thought, either with the police or with the utility companies. They've been dealing with a lot of situations like this, I think, in the last few years. But nobody's really been concerned about that. I mean, I feel like in the city and in this neighborhood, which is sort of on the edge of being stable and being settled, people are happy if someone's there keeping things up and not selling drugs, which that's what I've been doing. Keeping things up and not selling drugs. And this is a dark walk, like down there and around the corner.
On a tour, you can see not just the original design of the mansion, but over 100 years of renovations and updates. Nearly every decade of the past century of home design can be found at some place in the mansion. One room looks like the set for The Great Gatsby. The one next to it is straight out of The Brady Bunch. In the basement, the electrical system has been updated many times, but the old gear was never removed. What's left behind is practically a museum of obsolete fuse boxes and electrical systems. There's even a coal bin. Valerie explains this room has surprisingly turned out to be one of the most popular in the mansion.
What we have on the corner, the best, the largest on-off switch ever known to man. This thing is like as big as my head. It looks like something that Frankenstein would use to bring something back to life.
When I was, this is Elizabeth, when I was bringing people on tours, I did not realize that the on-off switch would be such a draw, but many people want to get their picture taken with the on-off switch because it's just so comically delicious.
Although Elizabeth Sherman has cut back on arts events, she still has her Hyde Park mansion.
If you missed part of Casey Kearns today, you can catch individual stories or hear the whole show online at kcur.org, and we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
The bucking bull has long been the embodiment of the American rodeo, brute animal strength in a contest with the cowboy trying desperately to stay on the bull's back. In the last 10 years, bucking bulls have become a major industry, with the price of the best bloodlines soaring up to $250,000 and competitions from Madison Square Garden to Wyoming. As Laura Ziegler reports, the bucking bull business is gaining the money and prestige once reserved for horse racing.
It takes just 4 seconds for a strong young bull to reap its owner as much as $50,000 in prize money. 4 seconds is how long each 1 and 2 year old bull will wear a weight strapped to their back. Each one of the massive animals will be judged on how high they kick and how much they twist.
You know, we're trying to breed our bulls to be more athletic build.
Randy Shippey is a slight man in an orange T-shirt that says House of Jesus. He owns Shippey Rodeo Bulls in Colombe, South Dakota. He's got 7 bulls in this regional competition used to get young bulls ready for the contest with higher prizes. A massive 2-year-old bull thrusts his back legs in a killer kick against the metal walls of the chute, defying 4 brawny cowboys trying to place a blue box known as a dummy on his back. By throwing off the box, the bull's learning what it's like to throw weight from his back. It's supposed to get him ready to throw off a determined cowboy in a year or two. Shibby says training bulls this way is only one new thing about the sport.
In the old days when they were raising rodeo cattle, you know, it was longhorns because they wanted horns and color. And, you know, we're trying to, you know, get animals that have lots of kick, speed, intensity, you know, where they're really whipping. And so, I mean, them are things that we look for.
This next bull out is going to be 1008 Pork Chop from Ramey Divot.
Over the past 10 years, prize money in the bucking bull business has increased tenfold, industry officials say, because of the combination of more sponsors, greater competition, and television contracts. Tony Wieborg owns this bullpen and ring.
People like coming to bull ridings. You know, businesses know that, you know. Bull ridings, they draw a good crowd. So, you know, they get a lot of bang for their buck.
I'd like to thank our general sponsors, West Point Livestock Auction, Countryside Photography out of Pender, Nebraska, Lawrence and Lumber out of Pender.
The national bucking bull competitions, of course, attract weightier sponsors. Ford, Stanley Tools, Evan Williams Bourbon. The industry's also grown as major networks sign on to air bucking bull events. Matt Sharping, a Minnesota genetics company executive whose stiff collar looks a bit out of place in the dusty ring, gets publicity from a bull he co-owns with All-Pro defensive end Jared Allen. The winnings support Allen's charity to help wounded soldiers.
I went to him and I said, you know, I think this could be a great fit for you, you know, that we could, you know, raise some money for the charity. And that's what we've done. And since March, we've raised $33,000. The bull industry has.
The bucking bull industry has grown by 500%, according to the Professional Bucking Bull Association. Entry fees are up, and prizes are 10 times larger than they were 10 years ago. Spectators and investors here in Pender, Nebraska, know they might not win big. In fact, they might lose what they've spent on the sport, but it's the challenge, they say, even the romance of literally rubbing shoulders with an enormous bull, an icon of the rodeo, that inspires them.
My other business bankrolled some of this hobby I have with the bucking bulls.
Has it paid off?
Probably not. I mean, what I've invested my money over the years, yeah, I haven't gotten all my money back yet.
Ivan Stolfus knows this is an expensive, high-risk hobby. But as the stakes keep growing, more people like him are getting into the game, in turn making the stakes grow even higher. For example, the Professional Bull Riders Association says its world championship in Las Vegas this fall will pay its top winners $2 million. For KCUR News, I'm Laura Ziegler.
You've probably seen crime shows like CSI and America's Most Wanted, where artists work with victims to get a drawing that helps identify a criminal. This job is performed by a forensic illustrator. If you've seen one of those drawings on the news in Kansas City, then you've seen the work of artist and author Lee Hammond, who lives in Overland Park. As part of our KC Currents Odd Job series, Suzanne Hogan met up with Lee this past fall to look at how, by using memories, the face of a suspect or victim can come to shape.
A day can change quickly for artist Lee Hammond. She's been working on call for the Kansas City Police Department for over 30 years. She says you never know when you'll get the call to come in and help solve a case.
I take my little bag here that's got my drawing pencils and the things that I use for shading and erasers, and you know, I'll show up immediately.
Using these tools and facial identification books, which are filled with pages of examples of different physical characteristics, Lee sits down with victims or witnesses to try to turn a memory into a composite drawing.
Everybody thinks, oh, I couldn't describe my own mother. Well, you probably couldn't, but when you compare it to pictures, you know when it's right and you know when it's not right. And so through process of elimination, it almost gets exciting and fun, and they kind of forget what they went through, and it's like a whole different situation.
Lee's been doing this for a long time, and she says there's one major common misconception about this line of work.
People don't really understand what a composite is. They want it to be a portrait, and when they see the drawing and they see the mugshot of the person we've apprehended, you know, if it doesn't look identical to the guy, they think it wasn't a good composite.
A composite drawing is supposed to represent a grouping of facial characteristics to create a category that helps police officers narrow a search. Now, working as a forensic artist is only one small part of what Lee does for work. Inside her home studio in Overland Park, she works as an art teacher nearly every day of the week. Today, four women are chatting and working on paintings of their grandchildren or forest landscapes. It's a stark contrast from a crime investigation.
Oh, that was so much fun.
She shows student Susan Sinclair how to use a sponge to add details to a tree trunk.
Gives you texture without it.
Sinclair is a freelance artist for Hallmark and has been coming here for classes for over 10 years. But when she first signed up, she didn't know that Lee was painting more than animals, flowers, and celebrity portraits.
I didn't know about any of her other careers. Or the fact that she was in America's Most Wanted.
Lee's drawings have played a major role in solving local and national cases, much like some sort of superhero. She can transform quickly to answer the call.
I can feel myself changing from the person I am in this room that's kind of goofy and all over the place and having fun with my students. And I get called and I get in the car and I can feel this change coming up over me where I'm straightening up and I'm getting more firm. And by the time I park my car and I walk in that police department, I'm a different person. So I morph into this forensic investigator, if you will.
Art has always been a part of Lee's life, but before she was an art teacher or did forensic art, she had hopes of going into law enforcement. She worked the late night shift for the Lincoln Police Department and was preparing for the academy. Sometimes she would bring in outside art projects to help pass the time during the long, boring shifts. Other officers there were also super bored, and while watching Lee draw, they decided to make up a game.
They would come in and they would pick out the ugliest people they could find out of their mug files and try to describe them to me. For some reason, it came easy to me, and I was like spot on, and it became, you know, draw the ugly mug shot every night.
And the practice from this game paid off in a very real way. One day, the day lieutenant called her in to do a composite for an abduction case.
I was just freaking out. I didn't know what to do.
But they figured Lee giving it a try was better than nothing, so she had a go at it.
I worked with her for about 5 hours, and we got a drawing. And the very next day, we apprehended him because the drawing looked so much like him that his own wife turned him in, saw the picture in the paper, and turned him in.
From that point on, they decided not to send Lee to the academy, but instead to Smith & Wesson forensic training. There, she learned about the facial anatomy of different races, interview techniques, how to make sketches after a body has started to decompose, age progression, and some psychology. It's a combination of art skills and people skills. Building a rapport is key to the process.
Especially with rape cases, or especially women, they're a lot more at ease with me than some, you know, 6'5" burly cop that's sitting there, you know, doing the interview. So they'll tell me things that they wouldn't tell someone like that.
Lee steps aside from the art class to show me a portfolio of drawings that represent cases she's been a part of.
This was a gentleman that was found dead floating in a creek, and no one could identify him. Well, there's the Allie Camp murder. This was Precious Doe. Do you remember Precious Doe?
Precious Doe, the pseudonym assigned to the unidentified body of a young girl who was found decapitated in Kansas City about 10 years ago. The case shocked the community with its brutality. Now, you can't put somebody's death photo on the news to identify them, so Lee worked with law enforcement to create a rendering of Doe so that the community could help in identifying her and find her killer. But the case took a toll on Lee.
I worked on Precious Doe for probably a week. And I remember my son, he said that after he'd gone to bed, if he got up, he could see my light on down in the living room and he could hear me crying because it was that disturbing. And I never really got over that one.
Like any profession that deals with violence and trauma, it can have its emotional challenges in hand with the technical. With more and more departments using computer programs, finding someone like Lee who does composites by hand is becoming more rare. She says computer programs are better than nothing, but still believes that a personal, hands-on approach leads to more accurate results, which make the job that much more rewarding. Lee's accuracy record for identifying victims and suspects in cases is 100%. For KCUR News, I'm Suzanne Hogan.
You can see a slideshow of composite drawings from forensic artist, teacher, and author Lee Hammond on our website at kcur.org. This story is part of Casey Curran's Odd Job series. If you know someone with an odd job, we'd like to know about it. Send us an email at kcurrents@kcur.org. Coming up, how one custom horn maker helps bring the big brass sound of New Orleans to life. This is Casey Curran's.
This is Casey Curran's. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.
It's our year in review show. We're listening back to some of our favorite stories of the year.
Kansas City vocal artist Lee Langston has been a fixture on the local music scene for the past several years. His covers of neo-soul music have attracted a faithful audience of young urban professionals. Langston's tribute shows, celebrating the music of artists like Erykah Badu and Lauryn Hill, have drawn sold-out crowds. Back in July, Susan met up with him. He had recently assembled a musical tribute to the neo-soul artist D'Angelo.
The mostly female crowd started arriving early to the record bar. The lights were low, and the venue has a warm, cavernous quality. Dressed in the vibrant colors of summer, women sip Cosmos and French martinis while waiting for the D'Angelo tribute show to begin. I asked some of the women what attracted them to this event.
Lee Langston has always done a wonderful job of bringing wonderful sounds to Kansas City, especially for those of us that love the neo-soul R&B scene.
He always puts on a really good production. I mean, I just like the atmosphere of the events that he puts on, and it's always good music and good times with me and my friends.
I like that he supports all artists. He brings together artists that maybe wouldn't be working together. He shares a stage, and you don't have to do that, but he provides opportunities for everyone's personality to shine.
I've seen Lee do the Erykah Badu tribute, and I've seen the Lauryn Hill, and I think, like, Kansas City's lucky to have him. I'm thrilled.
Show starts, it's standing room only at the record bar, and the stage is crowded too. Not only is the prototype band on stage, but Lee Langston has invited a variety of local crooners to share their talents. The set begins with D'Angelo's hit, Brown Sugar. There's a mellow energy in the place as most people rock back and forth to the sultry and soulful music. The scene is electric, talented musicians, an enthusiastic crowd, and music that vibrates with passion. Not long after the record bar, Langston explained how he, like generations of soul singers, have learned music from his family and the church.
Pretty much everyone in my family either sings or plays an instrument. My dad is a singer. My mother, she did some singing. My grandmother was a singer. My grandfather back in Oklahoma was a performer also. My dad's side of the family were all heavy church, so all of them sang. I can remember at times getting together with them as a child, and my dad was like one of 13, 14 kids, and they would just get together and have these big music things at the house all the time where it would just, there would be nonstop singing, and I would just sit there as a child in amazement to just look around and go, wow, like my entire family, they are all singers. You know, I thought all my family were movie stars or something back then, because I'm like, they can all sing.
Lee Langston grew up in Kansas City, and he spent years performing with gospel groups like the popular St. James United Methodist Voices of Praise Choir. At first, he performed secular music for an occasional party, but he didn't get serious about performing it publicly until about 4.5 years ago. Since then, he's become among the city's most popular singers in the neo-soul genre.
Yeah, it's like feel-good grown folk music, but it's not old school, if that makes sense. It's like it feels good. It's very grown. It's very sexy. But generally, when you say grown, they go, "Oh, that's the old school. That's the old school. That's the Isleys. That's the," and it's not really the Isleys. You know what I mean? It's grown and sexy, kind of by itself, sitting over here.
And it still draws upon, you know, the soul genre.
Yeah.
Very much so.
I think what I like about the neo-soul genre is that it pulls in young and it pulls in old, as opposed to, you know, people just, they like to box you in things, and when it becomes adult contemporary, they're just like, oh, that's adult contemporary, so they'll just put it over there, you know. And neo soul seems to kind of reach out to a lot of different people within the soul music genre.
Now, you connect with your audience. What are you feeling when you're up there on stage and you're singing?
This may sound weird to some people, but I when I'm on stage, I kind of channel people's energy. Like, you know when you're getting good energy in the room and when you're getting bad energy in the room. And there are people that want to relate with the person that's singing. So, you know, all of our experiences are generally the same. You know, we've gone through a lot of the same things. So really, you just talk to them. You just engage. Some people find it hard to engage with people that are staring at them. But it's for me, I find it really easy to engage with them because people hear a song and you see them respond. It's like, yeah, that's my cut. That's my jam. You know, and you talk to them because they relate to that song.
Girl, it's only you can decide that if you have me.
Now, you seem to always be evolving in your creative projects. What inspires your creativity?
At the BET Awards just recently, Frankie Beverly got on and said something that really should have rang out loudly amongst all of the artists that were watching, is that no matter what they are doing, do the music that you like to do, perform what you like to do. Don't always fall into what everyone else says is hot, because people will, you know, if they feed that to you long enough, you'll believe it. And that's kind of how I feel about what's on the radio. A lot of what's on the radio is what they're trying to feed us to make us believe is hot, and a lot of it I don't like. I mean, it kind of is what it is. Soul music has kind of lost a lot of its soul, in my opinion. I am the supporter of the unheard voice. Like, there are all these amazing singers and musicians that we don't hear about in the Midwest. And I've always been on this like mission to make sure that people hear them. So when I started covering songs, about more than half of what I brought in were some of the underground artists that I had heard about in various places all over. And I wanted to introduce that music to these audiences. Well, the funny thing about it is since people here in Kansas City hadn't heard of a lot of the artists, they thought a lot of the music I was doing was my original stuff. So I had to kind of teach them, you know, well, no, that's not mine. Actually, that is this person.
My woman, why are you sleeping with my woman? Came as a total surprise. I just can't believe my eyes.
This is Susan Wilson, and you're listening to KC Currents. I'm talking to Kansas City artist Lee Langston, founder of the band Prototype. So if you're an African-American artist, do you face different hurdles as well?
Oh, yes. Here, it's no secret. I've had the discussion with several of the venue owners, and it's that piece of, you know, for the venues that don't have an urban demographic or don't do anything in reference to soul music, making them believe that, you know, they all see it. They have one image of how it looks in a lot of cases. And some of them will admit that they think it's going to be a crowd of rowdy people that come through. They think everything that's in the urban demographic is hardcore rap, which there's a place for hardcore rap, and they shouldn't fear that, because I've always kind of wondered, like, why would you have an issue with hardcore rap when there's hardcore rock and the crowds are the same? There's just a racial divide in that. So, you know, because I go listen to all types of live music, I see the same things play out, but I notice that there seems to be a fear when it comes to the rap genre that, you know, I see the exact same things play out at the venues with the rock genre, but it seems to be like, oh, it's just rock. That's okay. I'm not understanding why it's okay in rock, but not okay in rap. And it's been this thing of when I bring through my audience, which are generally urban professionals that love good, grown, sexy music. They're always shocked, and they talk to me about it later, and they're like, "Wow, like, where has this audience been? We didn't even know this audience existed." I'm like, "Yeah, they exist." And it's very difficult. It's almost a teaching thing that has to happen. When you bring your audience in, we have to show these venues that, yeah, we are out there. We spend our money just like everyone else. We come to have a good time. And when we come in, the venue's going to be left just the same way that it was, you know, when we came. So they, a lot of them don't get that.
Now, speaking of your tribute shows, you've done Erykah Badu, you've done Lauryn Hill tribute shows. What inspires you to do these types of shows in the first place?
It's that piece of realizing that a lot of that good music that we love, because like you look at Lauryn Hill's album, and every person that you could go walk out onto the campus and ask someone about Lauryn Hill, and they'll all say the same thing, like, that's a classic project that I could put on today and listen to it like it got released last Tuesday, and it still feels good like that. And it's something that came out in like 98 or something, you know. So it's just good music, and to me it's that good music that's missing. So for me, when people ask me why do I pick specifically, why am I specific about picking those artists? Those are artists that just changed the game for me. Lauryn Hill changed the game in music. D'Angelo changed the game in music. Erykah Badu really changed the game in music when she came out, and those are the artists that I picked.
Well, Lee Langston, thank you for joining us for KC Currents today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm glad that we got a chance to do this.
If you missed part of KC Currents today, you can hear individual stories or the whole show online at kcur.org. In the 7.5 years since Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans, a local man has played a role in bringing that signature brass sound back to the streets. KCUR's Sylvia Maria Gross paid a visit to this master craftsman in Olathe, who is custom making instruments for some of the top jazz musicians in the country.
A horn shop is a pretty noisy place. And it's not just trumpet and trombone players noodling. If you go behind the store to the workshop, you'll find it actually takes sound to make sound.
Sound is very much a part of our world.
Mike Corrigan calls himself the horn doctor. He knows the physics, chemistry, and geometry behind making music, from the unique properties of brass, copper, and silver to the angle of a bend on a horn bell. Most instruments nowadays are stamped out in modern factories, but Corrigan loves the magic of metalsmithing techniques used to make horns in the 16th century.
I could picture myself going back in time, and if I was to go back in time, I could, you know, do this.
The essential part of any horn, past or present, is that flared end, the bell.
The way that a bell is made is definitely going to have the biggest impact on how the horn plays and sounds.
And it starts as a sheet of yellow brass. Corrigan's antique brass cutter works like a giant can opener. He cuts a shape that looks like a Y, solders it into a cone, and hammers it on an anvil.
Try to smooth that out.
The end of the bell is shaped on a spinning lathe. Corrigan leans into it with a long rod that has a knob at the end of it. He says very few instrument makers hand-spin bells anymore. It's time-consuming and physically challenging.
You gotta put a lot of weight into that to get the metal to move.
Corrigan actually started this company based on his reputation for repairing trombone slides. You know, those long parallel tubes that slip in and out?
We have a special process for polishing the slides so they feel like butter. That's what we like to tell people, they feel like butter. So when a musician is playing a lot of quick notes, they don't have to be fighting their horn and have the slide interfering with what they are thinking in their head, because we want them to be able to portray their voice and their thoughts that they have with their music without having any difficulty from their equipment.
You're listening to the Mason Brothers Quintet. One of the brothers is Elliot Mason, the trombone player for Wynton Marsalis's Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra. And that horn he's playing? It's a Corrigan. Mike Corrigan grew up in Maryland. His high school band director found he had a knack for fixing horns and suggested he attend an instrument repair school in Minnesota.
After repair school, my teacher came up to me and said, "Mike, I think you would really enjoy making horns." And I said to him, I didn't even think of that. You know, I guess somebody's got to make them.
So from there, Corrigan apprenticed at a Boston manufacturer of custom brass instruments. He moved to Overland Park in 2004 because his wife grew up in the area. Corrigan started his new business in his basement.
The shop started to consume our living space. So that was the point we needed to move out.
He's now just 31 and has 11 employees. They repair woodwinds now, and they've started working with area schools and more local musicians. But Corrigan's reputation is probably growing faster in New Orleans. He made his first trip there the year after Hurricane Katrina.
I know a lot of people were going down to New Orleans to help rebuild houses and help with the cleanup and all that. But what I decided to do is bring the repair shop down, set up, and just repair horns for the musicians down there.
Corrigan and an employee set up a converted concession stand in the parking lot of a church in Treme. That's the traditional musician's neighborhood, the one that HBO series is about. Pretty soon they had a long line, including a lot of teenagers.
When we finished that last horn that first night, the kids all said, "Well, we want to show you that we thank you for fixing our horns. We're going to play you a song." And I'm thinking, it is midnight. That's all right, guy. You don't need to do that. They said, no, we want to show you our appreciation. There was probably a group of about, 18 or 20 kids, and they're just wailing, playing really loud, and it sounded awesome. It was great. But in the back of my mind, I'm really concerned because it's midnight. I don't want people, upset people. And then I start noticing people are coming out of their houses. And now I'm getting really nervous. But instead of yelling about the noise, they come out. They start clapping and dancing around. And I'm thinking, where on earth am I right now? This is crazy.
Corrigan has ended up going down to New Orleans once or twice a year to repair instruments. He's become particularly close to the rising star Trombone Shorty, who is playing here with the Rebirth Brass Band. They just won a Grammy for their album, The Rebirth of New Orleans. All but one of the musicians are blowing, you guessed it, Mike Corrigan's horns. Mike Corrigan hopes to move his Olathe shop to downtown KC someday to be closer to the music scene and to the musicians, if New Orleans doesn't steal him away. Sylvia Maria Gross, KCUR News.
You can hear an extended version of this story and see pictures of Mike Corrigan's workshop on the KC Currents website at kcur.org.
We end with some sad news. Soul Sister No. 1, Marva Whitney, died on Saturday the 22nd. The Kansas City native spent about 3 years singing with James Brown in the late 60s. Her James Brown-produced solo music has been loved by soul music fans and sampled by hip-hop artists for years. Marva Whitney was 68. Here's her 1968 song, Unwind Yourself.
Unwind yourself!
Thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Find us on iTunes, contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter @kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Suzanne Hogan and Alex Smith. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. Zach Lewandowski is our intern, and our theme music is by Approach. And of course, I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Happy New Year.